Welcome to this World Labor Hour special presentation, a speech by Illinois Green Party Chair Rich Whitney, delivered January 31st, 2015 at the Champaign Public Library in Champaign, Illinois. This event was sponsored by the Prairie Green Party Steering Committee. Whitney ran as a Green in the Illinois gubernatorial elections of 2006 and 2010, getting 10.2% of the vote in 2006. Beyond his political life, Whitney is a civil rights lawyer who is involved in the nationwide legal battles against the tobacco industry. He lives in Carbondale, Illinois. The first voice you'll hear will be Prairie Green Party Chair David Johnson, followed by David Green, who ran as a candidate for the new Illinois 13th Congressional District nomination in the 2012 Democratic Party primary. Next is Carl Esterbrook, the Green candidate for the old Illinois 15th Congressional District in 2002. Then Whitney begins his presentation with comments and questions from audience members. Towards the end, you'll hear Karen Arum, the Prairie Green Party's membership director.
Okay, welcome everybody for coming out to this premier event of launching the Prairie Green chapter of the Illinois Green Party. And we've got a couple speakers here today, mainly Rich Whitney, of course, past candidate for governor in 2006 and 2010. So with that, I guess I'll let whoever's next take over. David?
Okay. I'm David Green, and I ran for in the Democratic Party primary as a kind of Green Party facsimile a year ago and received 14% of the vote on very little money and was very encouraged by that. I think that if you're here, it's because you're dissatisfied with the two-party, two-corporate party system. We know that the difference is that whereas the Republican Party is completely and totally controlled by the 1%, the Democratic Party is only completely controlled by the 1%. That's what we have to choose from, and that's why we need a different choice. I think I focused on trying to understand how this system works and how to explain to people what happened to this system in the last 30, 40 years in which 70% of people no longer feel that they have any control or any influence over government policy. My thing is trying to explain that to people, not to you right now in my short time, but to have opportunities to explain that to people in the coming weeks and months as we begin to organize people in this Green Party chapter and try to explain to people what it is that we stand for that really is an alternative, that really is are things that can be easily done at a kind of technical level, but that are going to be very difficult at a political level. I think it's very clear how the society is working now, who it's working for. It's very clear how the government can work in the interests of the people in this country. It's just really difficult to explain to people what happened to their money and how the government can use their money to benefit them when they're being told every day by the mainstream media that we're out of money and we have to, quote unquote, live within our means. That's nonsense, and we have to begin to explain to people why that is nonsense. I hope to begin to help develop this infrastructure, a network of people that could hopefully begin to gather signatures and run candidates in the various local, state, and national offices that are in this district. I would hope to be one of those candidates in the future. This is an act of hope on my part, and we will see where that hope goes. But before we accomplish anything, we have to hope, we have to try, we have to keep going. And so I thank you for being here in the spirit of that.
Carl.
All right.
Carl, can you stand up for you, please?
Yes.
I have 3 minutes to explain why a Green Party is necessary today, and I can do it in less than that because I can do it in one term. The term is neoliberalism. The Green Party is necessary today because neoliberalism essentially is the name of the politics that occupies both of the so-called major parties. That's a term that I would say a majority of Americans probably have never heard, but it describes the politics that now go back the better part of 40 years and that have taken the form of the 1%'s control of both the Republicans and the Democrats. Neoliberalism is the program of both parties in Congress and of the president as well. In trying to say something about it, I wrote down 4 points that seemed to me to characterize these politics that were the result of a conscious, calculated construction by the American business class in response to the 60s. The 4 points are, first of all, globalization in the interest of the 1%, offshoring. Secondly, disempowerment of regional cultures by war and colonialism abroad. The high point of this, of course, is the crowning point of the Obama presidency, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The third point is the preeminence of the economy over humanity. Cutting Social Security, Medicare, food stamps at home, and of finance over industry abroad, deindustrialization. That is, austerity and financial and deindustrialization in the economy are the techniques of neoliberalism that are noticeable not only in Europe, where we have this week at least an interesting response to neoliberalism that holds out a lot of hope, I think, but also at this country. In this country, we talk of austerity as a European situation. Is of course the policy of the Obama administration. Obama's neoliberal economic policies, notably the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP, the European version of that, are opposed by a few liberal Democrats, the Ron Paul wing of the Republicans, and the majority of the populace, as is his mendacious expansion of the war now to Eurasia. Obama was elected by co-opting the anti-war movement and then pretending that he was winding the wars down. It's all a lie. War is the health of the state and of business. Neoliberalism and neoconservatism are united in the Obama administration and also in all its potential competitors in the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. That's why a Green Party is necessary. So we'll hear today some accounts of what is to be done against the rising tide of neoliberalism. It's something we all should be involved in.
Okay, thank you, Carl and Mr. Green, who you ought to be a Green Party candidate with that name.
So they say.
Yes, exactly. So
I heard that throughout my campaign.
Yes, no doubt. And we will remind you of that if need be. Okay, so first of all, thank you all for being here. I greatly appreciate you coming out on a somewhat gray January afternoon to hear a political point of view, something that maybe we need to see more of in our society. So as you can see, the title of my talk, The Fierce Urgency of Now, and I'll explain that title a little later, Why Green Political Action is Essential. And it is essential, even though, as we shall see, it is also extremely challenging and requires perseverance and a fair degree of tolerance of the extremely annoying habits and faulty reasoning of many of our fellow human beings. Or as Kermit the Frog says, it isn't easy being green. One of the things I hope you take away from this is that finding the policy solutions to our problems is actually the relatively easy part. We have those in hand. The question is how to get them enacted in an age in which big money has come to almost, and I add the word almost, thoroughly dominate politics, as Carl Estabrook was just speaking to. So, first, a little bit of an audience participation part here in this presentation. I just want to ask you, how would you, if you were to being asked to list some of the most critical problems facing society today, what would you want added to the list? Please, you know, raise your hand and just speak freely. Yes?
You have to determine a solution to the problem for the lack of class consciousness by the working class. One. Two, the environment, global warming.
Okay.
And three, pointing the finger at Wall Street for every single problem. It used to be all roads led to Rome. Today, all roads lead to Wall Street.
Okay. That's partly problem and partly getting into solution, but yes, that very good. Yes?
Greed.
Greed? Okay. You, sir.
Inclusivity. Meaning we tolerate and welcome people of all colors, creeds, beliefs.
Okay. So lack of inclusivity is the problem then.
And then jobs.
Jobs, of course. That's a big one. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. Okay, rising inequality, certainly. Any else? Yes, ma'am.
Environmental degradation.
Clearly. I would think that would make just about anyone's list. Any others? Yes.
The rise of the plutocracy is a deadly danger to democracy. And without democracy, we have no means to fix anything else, so that has to come before the rest.
Okay. Plutocracy, rule of the wealthy. Wealth dominating politics. Okay. Well, when I began to prepare this, I sat down and started to make my own list of what I consider to be the greatest social problems. First, I had to call from the list some things that just didn't make the cut. You know, things that are kind of annoying to me personally, that I thought, well, yeah, it doesn't really make the grade anymore. So these are a few things that I thought of that I scratched from the list. You know, Deflategate, the deflation of footballs, that's clearly a serious problem. I didn't really like the last Star Trek movie. That was a big problem. And I don't understand why men's pants are only available in even-numbered lengths. You know, clearly a major social problem. Why can't you find a length 33? It's just a problem. But seriously, then I thought, this is the list I actually came up with. And it's kind of broken down into categories, and I'm sure we could elaborate in this in any number of ways, but economic and social, there's unemployment, poverty, insecurity, inequality, as you mentioned. The attacks on labor, globalization that Professor Esterbrook mentioned, jobs being shipped overseas, so-called free trade policies like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Cuts to retirement security, both Social Security and pensions, in human services. Then there's the environmental, and I put climate change in kind of a class by itself, but then there's the other things, fracking, extreme extraction, GMOs, endocrine disruptors, and so on. Then I have a couple under education, the fact that there's cuts and attacks on both grade school education and higher education, and the enormous problem of student debt in this country. The problem which Carl also mentioned, the permanent warfare state that we're in, the human and financial costs of militarism and near constant war and military aggression, the attacks on representative democracy, which I put kind of two subcategories. There's the attacks on privacy, civil liberties, the things that Edward Snowden talked about, growing executive autocracy, police state tactics, both national and local, witness Ferguson, and then corporate and financial domination of politics, the word plutocracy, sir, that certainly fits in there. And, you know, when we say a top 10, or we might call this a bottom 10 list, obviously, we can think of other things that the number 10 is a little arbitrary. We could also talk about lack of access to healthcare, our corporatized culture, violence, our criminal justice system, and so on. But this is roughly what I came up with in my top 10 list. All right, so now we need to ask, now that we've identified, I think, problems that I'm sure most of us agree of are pretty serious, We next have to ask some basic questions. Well, first of all, Let's ask ourselves, how long have these been recognized as problems? Well, unemployment and poverty has been, despite efforts to fight it and you know, hills and valleys, basically been a problem for quite a while. It's been growing in intensity lately, especially since 2008. The problem itself has been around. Same thing with rampant inequality between extreme wealth and extreme poverty. Attacks on labor, globalization. Well, you go back to NAFTA, which was during the Clinton administration in the mid-90s, jobs being shipped overseas, this whole trend in so-called free trade policies, been around for a while. Cuts to retirement security and human services. First, they went after the private pensioners and shifted things from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans. Now they're going after the public sector workers. They inch forward and keep trying to make these flank attacks on Social Security. So that problem has been around for a while. Human-caused climate change, I remember, I don't know about you, my high school science teacher in the early 1970s was telling me about greenhouse gases and the theory of climate change, and now it's become a reality. So, and scientists have known about it since the 1950s. So clearly that's been around a while, and certainly it's become a serious problem for at least 20 years, and where policymakers should be paying attention, so that's been around a while. Other environmental degradation has been around since the industrial age in different forms. The attacks on education, basically in Illinois, roughly the last 15 years, it cutback after cutback. If you measure in terms of inflation and change in population, we've had roughly about a 25% cutback in funding for public education in this state since 2000. And higher education, well, we all know about that. Higher education used to be much more affordable. Now the student debt problem is completely out of control. The permanent warfare state. We've been in constant war since 2001, and actually the gaps before that weren't that great. Constant warfare state, military-industrial complex, 900 U.S. bases overseas. This has been an ongoing problem. Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex that he helped create in 1961. So we've known this is a problem for a long time. And the attacks on civil liberties is kind of an ongoing encroachment. The attacks on the Fourth Amendment, attacks on privacy, growing executive autocracy, used to be Congress has the exclusive power to declare war, and then you had the War Powers Act in the 70s, and then gradually we've empowered our president. Look what he did in Libya. Didn't even consult with Congress, just went ahead and had air attacks there. And we could give countless examples. And then the corporate and financial domination of politics, of course, that's been around for quite a while. Woodrow Wilson warned about that danger. You can go way back. Not to say that all of these problems haven't grown worse, which is another part of this, but we've known about all of these problems for quite a while. And we've also known that we've had to update our spyware protection for quite a while. All right, let me see if I can get rid of that.
They're already coming after you.
They're already coming afterward. Yeah, that's right, exactly. Hello, NSA, nice to see you. Hope you enjoy this talk. Okay, so why are we not advancing? See, the NSA has intervened. It's not letting me advance the... I'm hitting the little arrow and it's not... here we go. All right. Next, we ask ourselves, well, how would you rate the government's response to these problems? Well, we kind of just answered that, right? We know these have been persistent problems. And does anyone here think that the government's been doing a great job in responding to any of these things? Right? The mere persistence of them, the mere fact that most of them have been growing worse in recent times, kind of answers this question. Government hasn't been doing a great job. Well, let's now ask ourselves, well, how have people organized to resist or put an end to these problems? Well, sure they have. You know, the problem of unemployment, poverty, organized labor, there's anti-poverty organizations, there's groups like Public Citizen, progressive think tanks and lobbies. A lot, you know, there's groups that call attention to the problem of poverty and inequality. We had the Occupy movement that grew up in the last few years to make a statement about inequality. All of these, you know, so there are groups that are fighting these. The environmental problems, yes, you can name dozens of groups that are trying to fight against the despoliation of our environment. Greenpeace, Food and Water Watch, Friends of the Earth, Union of Concerned Scientists, the so-called Big Greens, like the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council. I hate that term, Big Greens, you know, we're the Green Party, but whatever. That's the name they have. There's many organizations that are resisting on that front. Education, the teachers' unions are fighting, parents' organizations. There's groups like Voices for Illinois Children. The universities themselves constantly go to the government asking for more money. And there's student organizations calling attention to the problem of student debt. Against the permanent warfare state, we have an active peace movement in this country. I've been at demonstrations with over 500,000 people protesting against the Iraq war. You know, there are many people fighting and resisting against this. The attacks on privacy, yes, you've got the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights, the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, Public Citizen, Common Cause, Center for Responsive Politics, and so on. There are people have organized to fight these things. People have fought back. Now, true, just because the corporate-controlled media doesn't cover the fight back very well and kind of underreport it, that doesn't mean that the pushback hasn't been occurring. It has been occurring. I'm sure many of you here have been engaged in one fight back or another on one of these issues or more. So, but then we have to ask ourselves, well, how are these groups that I just identified interacting with the political system as tons of money flows into the Democratic and Republican Party to buy political results, which is basically what has been happening? Well, they kind of fall into three categories. There's the groups that say, well, we're not political. We don't care who's in office. We don't get involved in that. We're just going to push for what we believe in and try to influence whoever's in office, regardless of what party. We don't care about that. And then there's the groups that, like Sierra Club, for example, or Illinois Environmental Council and so on. Well, we're officially nonpartisan, but we'll send all the candidates our questionnaire, and then we'll pick the Democrat, you know, regardless of who answers the questions best. And we've run into that many times. So they're officially nonpartisan, but in reality, they still siphon their support basically to the Democratic Party. And then there's groups, unfortunately, like most of organized labor, not all of it, but most of organized labor that has a longstanding bad marriage with the Democratic Party, abusive marriage, actually, with the Democratic Party. And we support our friends in the Democratic Party. And this has been the relationship. And here we are in the Green Party. Hey, what about us? You know, look at our platform. It's your platform. Why aren't you supporting us? Well, this has been kind of, if you look at political strategy, this is what we've seen over the last decades. And we have to ask ourselves, well, how successful have these groups been with this political strategy? Well, not very successful because, as we already noticed, all of these have been long recognized problems. This strategy of basically funneling what funds and energy these groups have in politics to the Democratic Party obviously has not been working. So, next, let's talk about the dilemma we face with this, or you might call it the tragic irony of the situation. Even though we have the exact same political agenda as these movement groups, organized labor, the environmental groups, the social justice groups, peace groups, pro-education, the pro-civil liberties, pro-democracy groups, we have the same agenda, which provides us with about 80% of the Green Party's platform, and we promise to fight for their agenda if elected, these groups continue to support the so-called lesser evil politics of the Democratic Party because we're too small and we can't win. Now, does anyone see the irony here of this? All of these groups together comprise the majority of people, or certainly the majority of sentiment, of the American population. So here they all are. Well, we like the Green Party, but it's too small. We can't support it. Wait a second. You know, if all of you groups joined with us, we wouldn't be small anymore. We could beat the big money power of the two pro-corporate parties, the two corporate-sponsored parties. But instead, you continue to do this in the hopes that maybe the Democrats will throw you a bone once in a while, which they occasionally do, but not much of a bone these days. So the obvious solution is we need to get these groups to understand that it's in their own self-interest to support their own political party. And if these same groups would do that, guess what? We would become bigger. We would start winning elections. We would become a real challenge to the power of the big money parties, and they would be the ones saying, what the freaking hell is happening here? Okay? So this is obviously, the potential is there, in other words, the potential of making a major shift in the political situation in this country is clearly there. If we get these same constituent groups to, you know, to realize this and see this big picture in this way and start to act in their own self-interest. So the question is, how do we get from here to there, from the current situation to the one, you know, that I just showed in the last slide? Do we need some kind of new enlightenment, better organizing, better connecting electoral work with movement work? Do we need better branding and marketing, an image makeover, using scantily clad women to attract attention? The answer is, I don't know. I really don't. I know part of the answer, and we're going to get to that in a second, but if truth be told, I don't know. All I know is it must be done. And I've got more bad news before I get to the good news. To meet the challenge, we must overcome other dilemmas. Here's one of them. Because corporate control has corrupted government, rendering it less able to serve the public good, more people fall for the rightist propaganda, for example, the Bruce Rauner campaign, that government is the problem and more privatization, running government like a business and smaller government is the solution. Well, this becomes self-reinforcing to a degree because you cut the budget for government, you get poorer government performance, poorer services, and oh, see, government's not working, so let's shrink government because it's not working, let's privatize. And we've seen this vicious cycle in our politics. This is what's been happening with education. You know, the call, oh, we need charter schools, we need to privatize, and public transit, you starve it, and then, oh, well, it's not performing very well. Why would we continue to throw money at the trains and public transit when it doesn't perform very well? And the postal service is a big one, you know. They actually passed a bill in Congress that forced the United States Postal Service to prepay in their pensions for decades in advance. And then they turn around and say, well, the Postal Service isn't working very well. They just raised your rates again. We need to look at privatizing that. This kind of thing goes on and on and on. You know, now they talk about public-private partnerships and so on. Here's another dilemma. Many of those with the most to gain by getting a good green government and the most to lose under the status quo have become so jaded by the power of big money over politics that they become too discouraged to vote. And, you know, these are responses out in the field. I've done a lot of petitioning and so on. You know, these are typical responses we get from people. I don't pay attention to that stuff. I don't, you know, politics isn't for me. I don't care about politics. They're all a bunch of crooks and liars. And so generally, election after election, we get lower and lower voter turnout, including from the people that should care the most. And of course, there's these perennial favorites. I'd like to vote for the Green Party, but they're too small. Well, if you'd join with us, we'd get bigger. Or I'd really like to vote Green Party, but I don't want to throw away my vote. Well, isn't someone who won't represent you throwing away your vote? Or I'd like, this is one of my favorites. I'd like to vote Green Party, but they're too disorganized. Well, you know, if you'd be part of us, we'd have more people to organize. We'd have more of an organization. We'd be better organized. Or I'd really like to vote Green Party, but they don't seem to be getting anywhere. Well, Illinois Green Party was founded in 1999. We're only 16 years old. We've already gotten people elected to office. You got to take a little bit longer view of history, I think, before you can criticize us for not getting anywhere. And, and I forgot one that I didn't put on that last slide. My favorite, the last refuge of the diehard Democrat, Ralph Nader caused George Bush to win the 2000 election. And of course, as Carl Estabrook was pointing out, of course, things are so much markedly better now that we have a Democratic administration. However, we do have some things going in our favor. Now we're getting to a little bit more of the good news. For one thing, we have the real solutions. And as I indicated earlier, they're coming from the groups that have already had them for years. And we hear this from organizers, you know, let's fight for a living wage. We need fair trade, not free trade. We need progressive taxation. Let's tax the speculators. Let's enact monetary reform to fund our schools and services. The environmental groups have a lot of solutions too, peace groups and so on. Actually, for a lot of the problems that we face as a society, like environmental pollution and the problem of war and the attacks on civil liberties and so on, the solution's real easy. It's called stop. Stop doing it. Stop going to war. You know, no longer authorize money to attack other nations. No longer continue to attack the Fourth Amendment and our rights to privacy. No longer fund the national security state. So in some cases, the solution is real easy. It's just called no. But in other cases, it takes a little more work. But the solutions are really there. And one thing I just wanted to call brief attention to is, you know, you mentioned, pro-education groups, some of them are making the call for tuition-free higher education, and we just got the fairly poorly thought out kind of weak version of that with Obama's call for free junior college by robbing people's accounts in order to do that. But really, we have to be looking much greater than that. I wanted to just share this with you. The average tuition at public colleges and universities in the United States today is over $16,700 a year, and total student debt has topped $1 trillion, just past that this last year. Our current policy has created a generation of debt servants, but it would cost about $155 billion a year to provide public higher education tuition-free to all U.S. students at current attendance levels. Instead, the federal government lent over $114 billion to college students in the current fiscal year, creating future debt, and it gives away over $40 billion a year in tax breaks for higher education, which generally benefits wealthier families while leaving lower income students to scrape to get in and incur larger debts. But if we do some of the things that we can do with progressive taxation and taxing the speculators and reinvigorating our public sector, we can easily afford that money. In fact, just taking the $114 billion that we're lending to college students today and putting that toward tuition-free college education would be a pretty good start. This is not a pipe dream. This is very affordable. This is very doable. And as a matter of fact, not many other countries already do this. And it wasn't that long ago that some states used to do it in the United States, like California. But we've gotten away from that, and instead, higher education has become a vehicle for the speculators to prey on another class of debt servants. Another piece of good news. We've elected people to office, and we've already come close to getting a foot in the door in Springfield. These are a few of our office holders. It's Jessica Bradshaw, who is on the city council in Carbondale. Peter Schwartzman, who is on city council and is running for re-election in Galesburg. Steve Alish, who was with the Parks District, Bruce Samuels with the Library District, and one of their friends at a Green Party event. We've elected people to local office. We've elected people to community college boards, park boards, library boards, public school advisory boards, things like that. Yes, it's low level, but we're only 16 years old. We've already had some successes, so we have that going for us as well. And we're ahead of the pack in promoting a number of ideas that have since become mainstream. Now, these are, compared to global warming and things like that, these are maybe smaller victories, but we've had a few, and the Green Party was out in front, like marriage equality. That's a picture of Jason West, the mayor of New Paltz, New York, who back in 2004 performed the first out gay and lesbian marriages despite being criminally charged. He went ahead and did it anyway. And he said at the time, you know, I think in about 10 or 20 years, I think this is going to become a lot more normal and less controversial. Well, it turns out he was pretty right on the mark on that. Other things, criminal justice reform and prison reform. It's taken a long time. We've been talking about it for years, but finally some things are starting to happen where even the plutocrats are starting to realize, boy, this is getting pretty expensive locking all these people up, especially for nonviolent crimes and things like that. We did have the sentencing reform where they tried to balance between powder cocaine and crack cocaine, so it was less racially biased. Some things are starting to happen. We ended the death penalty in Illinois. Ending prohibition of cannabis is becoming more mainstream. We've been talking about it for years. Immigration reform, obviously a major topic. We've been talking about it for years. The local foods movement catching on. We've been talking about it for years. And just the whole concept of sustainable living and sustainability in general is something we've been talking about for years. And then there's the fact that unlike the two corporate parties, we're a values-based party. We're united by core principles. We're not a money-based party, right? And these are the 10 key values of the Green Party that unite us at a level of principle and from which our policy ideas emanate. And these are good values that I think are, for the most part, majoritarian values that I think most people, if you didn't say Green Party, you just asked them, well, do you agree with social justice? Do you agree that grassroots democracy, that people should have more power over their government? Most people would agree, and as a matter of fact, as my friend Sarah Heyer from the Shawnee Green Party once said years ago, and I really like this phrase, most people are already Greens, they just don't know it yet. And I think that's true. And it's also important to put our struggle in historical perspective and not get discouraged too easily. Sometimes we need to give ourselves a break. There is a tendency sometime within our party to assume that, well, if we're not making progress fast enough, maybe we're doing something wrong. And maybe we are, but we're trying to accomplish something monumental, you know, something that hasn't been done in 155 years since the Republican Party became a major party. There's no roadmap for what we're trying to do. We have some ideas about what we want to do, but there's no clear guidance. We're learning by doing. We have to learn by doing. Do I know we're going to succeed? No. But do I know we must keep trying? Absolutely, yes. And that's why I call this talk The Fierce Urgency of Now. Dr. King, in his Beyond Vietnam speech at the Riverside Church in 1967, talked about the fierce urgency of now in this speech. And talked about, you know, you can't procrastinate, and I really like this phrase, over the bleached bones and jumbled residue of numerous civilizations, or in the pathetic words, too late. And when he was speaking about it at that time, of course, he was talking about Vietnam, and the question was the war machine's impact on society. And you can see the other quote there, that a nation that continues year to year to spend more money on military defense than in programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death, and here we are. And maybe, at least as far as the official society, we are spiritually dead, but the people aren't. However, while the war machine problem continues, and that alone lends new currency to the fierce urgency of now, We also have something else that lends currency to the fierce urgency of now, and that is the problem of global climate change. And this is kind of a long quote, and I've got a lot of wordiness here, but basically, the most recent studies say that we have to leave most of the carbon fuels in the ground if we're to have even a chance of staying below this two degree centigrade tipping point, beyond which the effects of global climate change will just keep cascading, and it will be irreversible, and we'll see even greater catastrophe than we've already seen. By the way, I did bring a limited number of pamphlets from our candidate in the 12th Congressional District, Paul Bradshaw, that talks about the Green New Deal, that I invite you, I guess I may not have brought enough copies, but I invite you to take a look at, talking about this problem. But to those who say we can't afford to act now because of the economic cost and the trade-off in jobs, well, one thing I would like to share with you is from this pamphlet, excuse me, where she talks about contrasting the money spent on things like coal and fracking for natural oil and natural gas and so on. If you spend $1 million investment in oil and natural gas, it creates 5.2 jobs per $1 million. If you invest $1 million in coal, it creates 6.9 jobs. But if you invest $1 million in building retrofits, it creates 16.7 jobs. If you invest it in mass transit or freight rail, it creates over 22 jobs. In smart grid, 12 jobs. In wind power, 13.3 jobs. In solar energy, 13.7 jobs. So the very things that we need to do to avert climate catastrophe would be far better for our environment. This whole false dichotomy that we keep hearing of, well, you know, we'd like to do something about global warming, but, you know, we need the jobs now. It's an economic problem. No. If we shifted our priorities, we'd create a lot more jobs, a lot more economic opportunity, a lot better jobs. And then, of course, there's always this final point. If we continue the way we're going. That's, by the way, a picture of the Canadian tar sands or part of it. Yeah, lovely, isn't it? It's gotten so bad that, and I've seen a few of these articles like this, that climate scientists are actually going through the five steps of grieving. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I've seen this in more than a few articles, because it's become so frustrating, where the science is so clear and the evidence is so clear that we need something very dramatic changes right now to avert catastrophe, and yet they're still debating in Congress whether it's even a real thing. But on a more hopeful note, I like this article from Daphne Wisham of the Institute for Policy Studies, and she says, you know, yeah, it's a problem, except she's talking about the five stages of grief and how things are really getting hopeless because droughts, floods, storms, and forest fires are all becoming the new normal. But she points out we need to think of a sixth step, and that is work. It means taking the courage from each other as we look this monster in the eye and fight side by side in the battle of a lifetime. Systemic change, not just light bulb change, is what's required now. And I really like that despite this, there's always the tendency, the understanding that giving in is not an option. We have to continue to fight. So, in summary, we know what the challenges are and the dilemmas that I pointed out. We know what our strengths are, we know what the stakes are, and we know we have no choice but to keep trying. We have ideas, but we don't have any magic answers because this particular project hasn't been done before. But we do know we do need one more thing, and that is you. The Green Party cannot succeed without human agents of change to help it become what it needs to become. Within each one of us is the potential to become part of the solution. The party is not some abstract it. And you remember I showed you that slide before about, well, the Green Party isn't organized enough, and it should do this, and it should do that. Well, it doesn't change unless people like you make a change. You know, to become what it needs to be, we need human agents. And it needs the people to become us, not an it. So we all become part of it and become part of the change that we all want to see. So another world is possible. Together, we can start to build it in Illinois, one of the most corrupt states in the nation. Together, we can address the fierce urgency of now and save the planet, planetary biosphere, and save ourselves from senseless privation and suffering. And together, if we want it to happen, and if we get involved, we can create a brighter future. Thank you. And I know local folks have had a mailing list or contact list circulating. So if you haven't seen that, please see Karen here. But I think we have time for a few questions.
Indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you need to make an announcement first?
No.
Or, okay.
8 minutes and a few questions, yes.
Yeah. So, yes, ma'am.
I'm not trying to be rude, but I think, in addition to me, most people in this room know all that you've been talking about. And what I'd like to know is, what is the plan for getting to people who sit home and watch the propaganda on their TV and read it in the papers or those stupid magazines that are out there? What is going to be done to get to those people? I would think you have to get out and stand on street corners. I think you have to go door to door, telling this among all of us isn't going to do any good unless you really get out there and find out what people want.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And it is difficult, and I can't go door to door and do this. I would love to.
You can. But
yes, exactly. And I do agree with you, because that's really become the most reliable means of communication. You know, I've always found it kind of odd. The more we have these modern means of communication like email and Facebook and Twitter and so on, what I've noticed happening is, as the more of them there are, the less effective each of them become. And, you know, so now I send out emails and, oh, I didn't see that email, you know, or, you know what I mean? Face-to-face contact, I think, is becoming actually more indispensable to political organizing, as well as creating community, real community, not virtual community. So I absolutely agree with you. And actually, that's one of the things, even though sometimes we hate to, because we have to get so many petitions to get our candidates on the ballot, in a way, the petitioning is good, because it forces us to get out there and get out to the festivals and the fairs and the parades and whatnot, and have the FaceTime with people. And I will say this too, that when our candidates have been most successful, it's when they've done some of that door-to-door work. And don't even wait to find people in the street. Go to their house and knock. So I absolutely agree with you. That's part of the answer. Yes, sir, and then we'll get to you. Go ahead.
Nonviolent civil disobedience. We have to get the attention of the people. And the only way to do that is to manipulate the media. And the only way to do that is to take busts if we have to, but a demonstration without any coverage is worthless. But we have to prove that we are an organization by doing things for people. One thing I liked about the occupation movement is that when people were getting evicted from their houses, they occupied their houses. You know, there were other reasons why the Occupy Wall Street movement failed. A lot of it had to do with no distinct charismatic leadership like we have in Greece or in Spain today.
Yeah.
But I think it is absolutely necessary that they have, under what banner? Under the green banner or whatever color. But in order to change this, we have resistance means freedom. You are not free unless you resist oppression.
Okay. For a second, I thought you were going to say resistance is futile, like the Borg. I'm glad you changed your sentence that way. Yeah. But it's interesting you mention that, because someone made almost the exact same point you did two nights ago at a meeting about the fracking threat in southern Illinois. Again, as I had on one of my slides, we don't have all the answers. There is no roadmap. Certainly, in appropriate circumstances, doing something like that to get the attention of the media, which is very good at ignoring us otherwise, certainly, I think, could be part of the answer. Yes, sir, I think you had a question.
I'm very sympathetic to what you have to say, but I see some problems. I'm not from this country, I should mention that, so my interest in politics in this country is somewhat academic. I think what, in order to have the things happen that you are describing, the American people will have to take a hit in the short term before the long-term benefits come into play. So, for example, more public transportation. People in this country absolutely love their cars. They drive everywhere. They don't take public transportation even when in cities that public transportation exists. So, climate change. I'm from India. You know, we are building a large number of power plants right now using coal because that is cheap to build. So, if that climate change needs to be averted, then that would mean a technology transfer would have need to happen from the rich countries to countries like mine. Again, that means that, you know, why would American people want their tax money to be given off to countries in the third world so that they can build power plants?
I know. Plants. Well, don't.
But questions seem to be a very difficult questions that I don't see the. I mean, there's a short-term self-interest that is in conflict with long-term self-interest of people in this country.
Well, don't worry about India, because now Obama is going to bring nuclear power plants to India, so everything will be just fine. I'm being sarcastic, of course. But to get to your larger point, I mean, I can't say you're wrong, but boy, after 2008, you know, most of the American people got a pretty good sock on the jaw. And I know for many people, they're a little short-sighted now. Ooh, gas prices are down. We can go back to driving what we used to. The media exaggerates that a lot. I like to think that there's more of us than we think there are that do understand and do take a little bit longer term of things. All I can really tell you is that I agree. It may have to get near that bad, but we can't afford to wait to let it get that bad, because it is the fierce urgency of now. We have to be doing something about climate change now. We have to be doing something about the war machine now. We have to be doing something to defend our civil liberties and privacy now. These things can't wait anymore. You know, and if it has to go to the point where it has to really hit people so they literally can't drive their car anymore before they come to their senses, that's going to be too late. We have to help the people come to their senses a little sooner than that. Yes, Marianne.
One of the things that that does reach the media is writing letters to the editor, and especially if you can keep them short and pithy, and don't give up on that, because I know there are times where I'll write 2-3 letters, show them two, and nothing happens, and then the fourth letter really gets a buzz, or I'll send a letter in and I won't see anything until 3 weeks later it comes in there. And then 2 weeks after that, I'll have people stopping me in the street and say, hey, did you write that? That's really
good. Yeah.
And attacking, what I find is most effective is attacking the quote, common knowledge that goes around. I mean, there are so many statements that people make because they sound, and they're just stupid. And I mean, even historical things like nothing to fear but fear itself. There certainly are things to fear but fear itself.
Yeah.
You know? Or you can be anything you want to be. I can't be a quarterback. You know?
Well, if you deflated the football enough, you could be. But anyway, I agree. Let's not neglect the old-fashioned things. We'll go to you and then you. I think we have time for maybe a couple more. Go ahead.
To the extent the Green Party is successful, it will become a target for the other side.
For what? I'm sorry?
The other side.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's already happened. But
who have other intentions than what the Green Party does. This is not normally a problem. It happens, but it isn't a problem. But if consensus decision-making is used, it's a terrible problem because they can bring the party to its knees. Do you use consensus decision-making?
We, in the Green Party, we use a modified consensus where we follow the consensus process, but if we don't reach consensus, then we shift to a majority vote. So, yeah, so that's, you know, every chapter may do it a little differently. And in my experience, consensus works most of the time because we're pretty clear on what the objectives are. But where it doesn't, hey, you go to a vote. Yes, sir.
What is the Green Party doing right now to organize and become a political party locally? And what is the very next step? I don't think that's really been talked about. What are we doing to actually organize right now?
Well, you're at one of them right here.
But I mean, to get rid of this, what's like the very next step? How do we actually get this going? How do we get people in office? Like, I mean, this is, we all know these ideas, but what are we actually going to do to get this accomplished?
Well, every election cycle, we're running candidates. And right now, even in the nonpartisan municipal elections, we're running candidates in many parts of the state. Unfortunately, not here because we're just starting to form this new chapter here. But in the collar counties, we've got people running for local office. We endorse some nonpartisan candidates for aldermen in the city of Chicago, as well as one of our own candidates. Peter Schwartzman is running for re-election in Galesburg. We've got other candidates going on. And every election cycle, we try to use that to build toward the next election cycle.
But what about in this town right now, here? Like, what are we doing to actually build something in this town?
Well, this might be a good segue to Mr. Johnson and Karen here to talk about that. Because I'm from Carbondale. I'm not from here. I am your guest speaker, but I'll gladly turn it over. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Anybody
I wasn't
signed the sign-in list.
I think we've got almost everybody. Yeah. Listen, we're the four of us who are the local officers. We just formed this organization. You've already met David Johnson as our chairman. Carl Estabrook's our vice chairman. David Green is our treasurer. I'm the membership bylaws person. We just started up in December, and this is our first meeting or get-together in order to hopefully recruit more members and to address the issues and concerns. We've been protesting. As members of AWARE, not only are we on television twice a week and on radio, David hosts a national radio program. I'll let him talk more about it, but we've been protesting once a month downtown against the wars. We've been holding a market or a table at the market disseminating information. And it's only of recent that we came to the conclusion that we really need to start working, as I heard you on the radio today, Rich, say, okay, let's start working from the inside, not just from the outside. And that's why we want to recruit people to get involved and start a movement to get people elected. So, David, how about you take it over?
Yeah, once we get, of course, we're just an intro. Once mm-hmm. we get more people involved, we're going to have new elections, of course, for people. So we're just, you know, I didn't want to be chairman. So I just want to let you know this is not a pre-imposed dictatorship by any means.
You're a steering committee.
A steering committee. Okay. I'm afraid we ran out of time. It's 1 minute till, and we're supposed to be out of here by 3 o'clock. So I want to thank everybody for coming today. Please, if you haven't signed the sign-up list, email and phone number would be perfect, but at least an email so that we can contact you. And let's see what we can do here in the Champion Band. Thank you.
You've just heard Rich Whitney, chair of the Illinois Green Party, address an organizing event for the new Prairie Green Party in Champaign, Illinois. This was the World Labor Hour Prairie Green Party production in partnership with DigiWorks Media Production. Our theme song is written and performed by Pete Anderson. ¶¶